I came to understand that self-help was actually pretty hard because I bring the help, but everyone has to bring the self. And the self means that they have to decide they need to change, which is hard. They have to decide they want to change, which is harder. They have to decide that they're worthy of the change, which is harder still. They have to be supported by people around them who are used to them either fitting into a box, fitting into a shortcut, being small so they can be big, right? Again, harder, harder, harder. And I realized that self-help is actually pretty awesome. That said, I also believe that most of the self-help industry is built to make you continue to need them so they can continue to sell you shit.
Hey everyone, Ronan here. You're listening to a Good Long Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Sizzle Brands, a company that I helped start, whose mission is to elevate the game in health and wellness by replacing all of the unhealthy, sugary, and fattening foods in our cupboards with healthy, nutritious alternatives. Our first product is Quench Hydration, which has been formulated to be the world's healthiest and best-made hydration drink. Developed by legendary strength coach Andy O'Brien, Quench has 7 electrolytes with a 3-to-1 potassium to sodium ratio, 0 sugar, 10 calories, and it tastes great. Cherry lime is my favorite flavor. For a 20% off coupon code, go to quenchhydration.com and use the code LEVY20. That's Quench spelled C-W-E-N-C-H. But you didn't come here to listen to me shill for my new company, so let's get on to the good stuff. On April 4th, 2023, 2 important books for understanding the human psyche and achieving your full potential were published. One was called Wonder Hell: Why Success Doesn't Feel Like It Should and What to Do About It by Laura Gassner Oddick. The other was called The Ketamine Breakthrough: How to Find Freedom from Depression, Lift Anxiety, and Open Up to a New World of Opportunities by Dr. Mike Dow and yours truly. One of those books became a Wall Street bestseller. The other one is called The Ketamine Breakthrough. One was featured on Good Morning America and Access Hollywood, among other major media outlets. And the other one was called The Ketamine Breakthrough. Okay, enough with the self-depreciation. The truth is that both books touched on important topics, and it's why I'm glad that after a few false starts, Laura relented from her no more podcast policy to join me here. Because I think the topic she engages in Wonder Hell, which is one you've heard me comment on quite a bit, is eminently important. So many of us, yours truly and Laura as well, get taught at a young age that happiness comes from a stable career and achievement, which we believe until we get there and realize that maybe it's not all that it was cracked up to be. Being open about this conversation, along with minimizing cell phone use and social media use, is, in my mind, one of the most important things we can be doing to, frankly, save people from needing ketamine-assisted therapy in their first place. Don't get me wrong, a good CAP session is amazing and illuminating, but give a listen to this conversation and you'll understand what I mean. Thanks for listening. Wanted to start with, you know, I don't know a whole lot about you, save for what I read about in Wonder Hell. And so I just wanted to hear your story. And I can either kick that off to you, which is, I believe you started your career in politics and got a master's in political management, which sounds like a very directed degree. But can you tell us about that experience? What drew you to politics in the first place? I'm very curious about that.
Yeah. So I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. And in the United States political world at that moment, we were dealing with the Iran hostage crisis. So there was a bunch of hostages that were taken. They were being held captive, and they were being held captive for a very long time. And as like a 7 or an 8 year old, I was like, I have been fed the story that the United States is like the greatest superpower in the world, except for when we're like hiding under the desks because we're thinking that Russia's going to like send a nuclear bomb and kill us all. Yep. And yet we have these hostages that we can't get out. So like, why isn't somebody fixing this? Why isn't somebody helping? And I, you know, I'm watching the news and they're being portrayed as like mommies and daddies. And I'm like, why isn't somebody getting the mommies and daddies out? And so somewhere in my brain was insert this idea that like somebody needs to solve the problem. And with every passing day of this crisis, I became more and more enraged about it and like righteously indignant about it. And I was like, I am going to like run for office and I'm going to be somebody who solves the problems. And so I just thought that that's what I was going to do. Like there wasn't any rhyme or reason. I didn't think that for any particular reason I would be the one to solve this problem. But I just thought that the problem needed to be solved. And Jimmy Carter wasn't doing it. And then Ronald Reagan came into office. And as soon as he came into office, it was like, miracle, they've been released. And I thought, well, that's what good leadership does. wasn't that I was a Republican or a Democrat. I just was sold a bill of goods by like the political world that like this just happened to happen. Obviously now as a grown up, I'm like, well, that was clearly orchestrated. It's really obvious when you think about it. But as a 7 or 8 year old, didn't really occur to me. So I thought politics was the way that problems got solved. And at the time, ironically, not Reagan, but most other politicians were lawyers. So I was like, well, I should go to law school. And again, it was like LA Law, Adley McBeal. It seemed super glamorous to be a lady lawyer. So I was like, I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to work in the for the public good. I'm going to like find the bad guys. I'm going to put them away. I'm going to get recruited to run for office. Of course, I'm going to win and I'm going to like solve the problems. And that's what I thought I was going to do. And I never questioned that. Until I got to law school, on the very first day, do you remember, if you remember being in law school and having that experience of like the kid who is called upon by the professor who gets asked question after question after question after question till they like just basically just, you know, fall apart in a puddle? Like that was me. And I realized that I was in the world's worst place. And so I did what a lot of young women in terrible situations do, is that I dated the world's worst boyfriend. And I joke around that the world's worst boyfriend had incredible taste in like three things. The first being IROC-Z's, the second being girlfriends, obviously, and the third being unknown presidential hopefuls from tiny southern states. And one day it was raining and he was like, I'm going to drive you home from campus, but I want to stop at this guy's campaign office. He's running for president. And I was like, Governor who? From where? Arkansas? Yeah. Not
racist.
A chance.
Don't want anything to do with them. Right.
Yeah. Not a chance. Never going to happen. Not a chance. George H.W. Bush had just won Desert Storm. He had a 91% approval rating. The Democrats were running like a total sacrificial lamb. And I walk into this tiny little strip mall campaign office in Gainesville, Florida. And there on this tiny black and white TV is a video of then Governor Bill Clinton. And he's giving this impassioned speech about service and how community service in exchange for college tuition is the way to change the world while also changing yourself. And it was the first moment in my life where I was like, oh, I don't have to solve the problems. We have to just put the right people in the right places to solve the problems. So I dropped out of law school and I joined the campaign. I started volunteering and he got to the White House and I got to the White House. And that's how I got into politics.
Okay. That's awesome.
That's the biggest yada, 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 by the way, in the history of storytelling at the end of it. But we can talk as much or as little about politics as you want. But
I'm super curious.
How I got there.
Okay. I'm super curious about it because like I've never been involved in politics. And the older I got, the more I'm like, why would anyone get involved in fucking politics? That seems like a terrible waste of a good human life.
I think politics is different now than it was then. So in 1994, Newt Gingrich had the contract with America, that I called the contract on America, right? But he ushered in a whole new wave of Republicans that were much more vitriolic. Yeah. You know, when Reagan was president and Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, they would fight all day long, but they'd have a scotch at the end of the day together. Like they didn't agree about everything, but they still believed in the systems of government. And that, you know, Newt Gingrich's group came in to basically dismantle the systems of government. And so it was just a very different thing. In addition to that, in the early 90s, Ralph Reed led the religious right. And what he did as a sort of young upstart was he seeded all the local PTAs and aldermen and city councils with evangelical Christians. And so everyone's like, oh, we lost Roe v. Wade under Trump. I'm like, no, we lost Roe v. Wade 40 years ago when they created the pipeline. Like we don't have it anymore. So in the early 90s, politics changed a lot. So I got involved in the sort of very hopeful, very idealist, I still believe in a place called hope, right? Like I got involved in this very idealistic time that very quickly disappeared and has just gotten worse ever since.
Right. Interesting.
I would never run for office now, ever in a billion years. Like you couldn't pay me enough money, but then sure. Different time.
Isn't that part of the problem though? Which is like all the good people are like, why would I fucking do that? I can make a lot more money and have a lot more fun and not be run through the ringer every single day by not.
And also maybe make a lot more impact.
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially.
So that is the problem. That is absolutely, it's a huge part of the problem. It's a twofold problem. I think the first problem is that good people are too smart to want to do it. They see what happens. And it's also different now too. Like nothing is off limits. So if you run for office, your whole family's running for office with you. Yeah. Like, it's just your husband, your wife, your kids, like everybody is fair play. And that's not all right. Right. That's just, that shouldn't be all right. And the second thing is that it's, we don't teach civics in school anymore. We don't teach civic responsibility. We don't teach people about the systems of government and how we can make change, and that the person that you vote for mayor is going to affect your life way more than the person, unless you're in the armed services, than the person you vote for president. And yet people don't show up to vote in their local elections. They don't show up to vote in the primaries, which gives, you know, everyone's like, oh, the two-party system sucks. Well, it's like, well, if you don't show up at the primaries and vote for the kinds of candidates that you want to send a signal to the two-party system that they should look at, then of course you're only looking at a third party, but actually there are independent thinkers in the parties that exist. You're just not out there talking about them in a way that tells the party to support them and fund them.
Right. And so I know this is not where the conversation is meant to go, but like,
I have a lot of bees in my bonnet about this.
No, listen, everybody fucking should. Everybody who's paying attention.
Yeah, everyone like, should. I know.
How did we get here? I have two questions, which is, I'll start with the more germane one, which is like, we've seen a loss of civil discourse and like just the whole cancel culture movement happening, which is like, no mistake is tolerated. Like if you have any degree of influence, you have a zero tolerance policy of any fuck up. And then if you fuck up, you're taken down. Do you think, you know, that started in politics and kind of expressed into the broader world, or did it kind of, did the broader world and all the social media stuff really bring that into politics? And then the second question is, you know, what the hell do we do about it? Like, what are your thoughts? Like, obviously someone who came from the politics, which I'll call it industry, it is like a political industrial system. It's like, gotta be doing something, because like the current status quo isn't sustainable. I don't think, you know, what should we be doing besides, you know, the always common lecture of like get involved, which people don't seem to want to do.
Yeah. I think the answer to the first question is, I think they're actually both fairly simple, to be honest. I don't know if cancel culture started in politics. I think it probably started in 24-hour news cycles. So it probably started in news radio and then cable news, where if it bleeds, it leads. So if it's not bleeding, let's poke it some more so it does, right? Like in the manufacturing of news and news narratives. And we see news narratives all the time. The New York Times has a narrative. Fox News has a narrative, right? Yeah. And CNN, they all have narratives. Truth Social, you know, X.com, like everybody, every social media platform, every news company, everyone has a narrative. And if the story doesn't fit the narrative, we don't print it. Right. So, so if you have 24-hour news and then you have narrative-driven news and then you have social media silos that people can go into and not have to have any inconvenient truths to them, right? Are you pro-Palestine or are you pro-Israel? It's more nuanced than that. And if you're pro one or pro the other, it's inconvenient to see humanity on the other side, right? Because that's tough. So the more inconvenient the truth, the more we get pushed into a silo of people who agree with us so that we never get canceled. So I think that's sort of how we got to where we are. What do we do about it? I think Jonathan Haidt's new book about restricting social media for young people until a bit later is, he's not wrong on that. I said it before, teaching civics in school. I think people don't want to get involved because they don't understand just how easy it is to get involved, how little you actually have to do to make change. Like, somebody can win the election of a fairly major city in the United States with like 10,000 votes. Like, it doesn't really take a lot to get involved and to start swaying things in a direction that you care about. But more so than that, the reason that I dropped out of law school was to join this campaign because of the idea of service, right? Yeah. Community service in exchange for college tuition. If people do not have access to the ability to raise themselves up in the world, right? You don't have access to college with this sort of increasing cost of college all the time. And by the way, if we don't talk about entrepreneurship and trades as just as valuable as college, that's a shame on us, because those things, there are lots of pathways to move forward. But if you feel like it's impossible to move up, you're going to feel like somebody's taking something from you. Who's taking something from me? That guy.
Yeah.
The other person. And if you're constantly othering other people, what's the best way to not do that? To actually know them as humans. And so it's an unpopular opinion, but I actually believe there should be compulsory service. that right. everybody should spend a year at least, maybe two, in some sort of public service, whether it's the military, whether it's public service, the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, teaching, some sort of public safety, firefighting. Because if you look at Congress in the United States, there is a very specific correlation between the reduction of veterans serving in elected office and the lack of civility that we have towards each other on the other side of the aisle. So I've raised a lot of money. I'm a progressive Democrat. I raise a lot of money for Democratic candidates, but I actually also support a nonprofit that recruits and trains and runs veterans to run on both sides of the aisle. Why? Right. Because I know we're going to have Republicans. So I'd rather have better versions of them. I also want better versions of Democrats. Yeah. I want somebody who has a history, a track record of putting country before self.
Yeah.
Because if they have that, then I think they'll probably be able to put country before self more often. And I just think we have lost the ability to put country before self. And I think about that in about every country in the world. Yeah. So I think some sort of forced way that we have to see each other and see each other's humanity by serving alongside each other, you're never going to convince me it's not a good idea.
I two thoughts there. One is, like, you called it like an inconvenient truth, but it's like, and I would say it's not just inconvenient, it's complex. Like, a lot of these issues are complex. There are no simple answers.
It's identity shifting.
It is, yeah. And people don't like complex things, right? In a world where we're so saturated with information and things to do, like, simplicity is valued, but simplicity isn't accurate. And in that notion, going back to your comment about Palestine and Israel right now, whatever side you're on, it's like, if you look at the Israeli society, ignoring what's going on an international basis, it works pretty damn well, in part because everyone has to serve and because there's a belief in the importance of the state and the nation and all that kind of stuff. So implicit in that service, but it's complex because there's a lot of things that are fucked up about Israeli society as well. You know, we're seeing it play out 24-hour news cycle right now,
but absolutely,
you know, you see the narratives of Israel bad, you know, people always being careful to say, well, not Jews bad, but Israel bad. But it's like,
not those Jews at least. Right. Not you, Jew, but the other Jews, right?
Yeah, exactly. Let's start other. Yeah. No, that's really on point.
I said to my kids, who are both on college campuses right now, I'm like, yeah. So Zionists are bad. What's a Zionist? Yeah. Like, define these terms for me. Because I was like, if I'm a Zionist because I believe that Israel should exist, then I'm a Zionist. If I'm a Zionist because I think Israel should get to, like, continue to expand onto land that may or may not be theirs, then I'm not. But, like, what's the term? Because my understanding is that it's just that Israel should exist. So are you saying it shouldn't? Like, what are you, like, what's, and it's very popular to say certain things. Like, people want to fit in. We all want to fit in. Like, that's, you know, evolutionarily speaking, if you get kicked out of the pack, you're going to die, right? Yeah. Like, you're going to be on your own. Nobody's going to feed you. No one's going to protect you. So, like, it's in our core cellular DNA to want to fit in. So these, like, they're all trying to fit in, but it's super complex and they don't understand it. And as you said, like, it is more than an inconvenient truth. It's identity shifting. It's identity threatening. And the narrative driven news and cancel culture doesn't lend itself to nuance and complexity. Yeah. It lends itself to, are you good or are you bad? Are you black or are you white? Are you evil or are you, like, where do you stand? Are you in or are you out? And that's it. There's nothing in between. And I think, you know, are you Republican or Democrat, right? Like, it's more of us are in the middle than are on the outside fringes. And we're seeing in both parties, the fringes getting fringier because of this need to, you know, let's keep making it bleed more.
Yep. No longer hoteling in equilibrium, but you just gave a perfect synopsis for exactly why I'm doing this podcast, is trying to add some nuance to the conversation, right? Because, like, it's got to happen somewhere and it's not happening many places. So my whole goal with this is to add nuance to it and at least help people think about things, if not, you know, find answers.
My kids were like, they were talking about whether or not they should go, like, join encampments and protests and all these things. And I was like, well, do you understand this millennia old issue that is canonically the most complex issue in the world, enough to get kicked out of school or get arrested for it? Because I've been on this planet for 30 years longer than you, and I don't know that I understand it enough. And I've been paying attention. I've gone to Israel. I've gone to Palestine. Like, I've seen these places, and I don't understand it. So please explain. You know, and they were like, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard. No,
it is hard. There's so many levels of complexity, and we don't have a whole lot of compassion for people being like, I don't know what to do. So no, I appreciate that. What prompted you to leave politics? When did you say like, I'm done here?
So, I was 4 years into it and I was ready to get back on the campaign trail. So I ended up in the office that created AmeriCorps, which is the national service program that over a million and a half young people have served in at this point. And I had done everything there was to do from sort of the speech writing to, politics, lobbying, sort of all the political White House presidential appointee stuff. And then I moved on to the program officer side. So I was giving grants and technical training and technical assistance to service programs in the states in the southwest of the United States. And then the 96 campaign was starting to gear up. And I went to my boss and I was like, yeah, well, I'm ready to get back on the campaign trail. And he said to me in the way that like only a father figure mentor can say, he was like, well, Laura, you're kind of too old to get back on a campaign bus and eat cold pizza and sleep on high school gymnasium floors. And I was 25 at the time. So, or 24 at the time, but that's like dog years, right? It's like, you're like elderly in campaigns. He goes, and you're kind of too young to be the domestic policy advisor. So go talk to my friend, Arnie Miller. He runs the biggest search firm in the world that does specifically mission-driven nonprofit university foundation advocacy searches, C-suite positions for those kinds of organizations. He'll find you a job in the nonprofit sector. And then you'll hide out there for 4 years and then you'll come back and do something big on Al Gore's campaign. Speaking of inconvenient truths, right? Yeah. Al Gore's campaign. Yeah. And I was like, great, sounds good. So the next week I sat down with Arnie at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. And within about 5 minutes of talking to him, I was like, wait a minute, your office is in Boston. The guy I'm dating now, who's not the world's worst boyfriend, but is actually, you know, the guy I ended up marrying, been married for 26 years. He's about to move to Boston. I should go work for this guy. So I was like, I should come work. What about not being one of your candidates? What if I came to work for you? And he's like, great, you should do that. And I was like, awesome. What do you do? Tell me what you do. And so that's how I became a headhunter. I worked for him for 5 years and I really learned from the best and the brightest how to do this work, how to see people, how to size them up, how to understand what makes somebody tick, how, you know, what organizations need in their leadership. I mean, I really learned from the top of the world in this. But I did not like the business model of executive search, which was right. One third of the first year's cash compensation for anybody that you place. Yeah. Plus 25% for anybody else you happen to place during the course of that work, even though you're not doing any additional work. Right. And I just kind of felt like when I was doing, say, the chief strategy officer for a $1 billion foundation, that's not as hard of a search than if I'm doing a director of fundraising for a local domestic violence shelter, right? One pays a ton of money. One is super prestigious. Everybody wants that job. It leads to great places. The other one isn't going to pay a lot of money. It's really hard work. You're begging people all day long. Like, it's tough. So who, and you know, and because like one job pays $60,000, which is going to give my firm $20K as a fee, and the other one's paying $300,000, right? Like, who do you think I am being incentivized to spend more time paying attention to?
Yeah.
The bigger, easier search. And I didn't like it. It didn't feel good. And I went into my boss's office one day and I was like, you know, there's a better way. And he was like, you know, there's the door. I basically presented the entire business plan where I was like, it's better for us. It's more authentic, you know, more authenticity, more profits for us, less cost for our customers. We'll do the work better. We're going to leave knowledge with them long term. And he was like, no. He's like, you can stay. Like, we love you. You're doing great work. You can stay. But if you want to do it your way, you got to go. And in that moment, I kind of realized that, like, I wasn't really part of the solution for my clients, which left me feeling like maybe I was just part of the problem. And once you realize that, and you know, as an entrepreneur, like once you realize that you're not solving the problems the way that you think you are, you got to do something or else you're continuing to be part of the problem. And so I left and I started my own search firm. And then I ran that for 15 years until I eventually sold to the women who helped me found it. And now I'm writing books and speaking. So I sort of had like politics, executive search, and then still executive search over the course of 20 years. But the second part was really entrepreneurship.
Right.
Because I was like running and growing and building, and now this career and sort of writing and thinking and speaking. So it's sort of had, I kind of have like had like had to have four careers or three since I left politics.
Okay, cool.
I don't know where you want to start, but
we're going to go through all of them hopefully a bit. I'm curious to know. So the last interview we did for this podcast, none of them have been published yet, was with Sanjay Singhal, who actually started a foundation called the Nikkeyan Foundation, and he funded a lot of psychedelic research. But he's actually now gone from, you know, philanthropic work to becoming a writer and sharing his thoughts and all that kind of stuff. Coincidentally, I'm noticing a trend actually. But he talked about like five heuristics he uses to kind of guide his life. And I'm curious to know, because you said from your time working in search, you could kind of size people up. I'm paraphrasing now, but pretty well, and get a good sense of them. And are there any heuristics that you still kind of look at? Like, was that just a gut intuitive, like a feeling of like, oh yes, I see this person. I understand their interests, their desires and all that kind of stuff. They're perfect here. Well, or is it a little bit more?
There's a little more. And I'm very excited you asked this question, because I think this is going to be my next book.
Ooh.
I haven't told anybody about this yet. I mean, I've told like 10 people about it, but I haven't talked about it publicly. Yeah. So here we go. My younger son goes to Brown, and he was stage managing a production, and in the first week of April, we went to go see this play. And one of the plays was called The Ghost of Bob Dylan. And obviously Bob Dylan's still alive, but it's called The Ghost of Bob Dylan. And the conceit of the thing is that Bob Dylan, the ghost of Bob Dylan, shows up at a coffee shop, like a coffee house where they're doing an open mic night. And he's going to just pick one of the singer songwriters who's there and decide that they're great, and then tell them all the ways that they can become the next Bob Dylan. And they were like, how will you know which one of us is great? And he like walked up to one of them and he like sniffed them from like toe to head. And he was like, I'll just know. And my husband was like, you say that all the time. And I'm like, I know. And then the next day into my brain popped basically a fully formed book title, subtitle, the whole thing, Greatness. How to spot it and stoke it and in ourselves and those who matter most. Because what I realized was that, yes, like my superpower is that I can see the greatness in somebody else and in fairly short form, like see it, pull it out of them and hand it back to them in ways that they can actually believe it and have enough confidence to act upon it. So how do I know? What do I look for? When we were in search, we never presented candidates that had 100% of what you were looking for, because our clients were always like, and they have to walk on water, right? Like there's just no possible way. And if you say like, I'll know it when I see it, it means you've seen it before, which means you're just contained and constrained by where you've been in the past. Yeah. So how do we take chances and how do we bring in talent that we've never seen before to do things we've never done before when we don't even know what the skills are we're going to need? Like if you would have told me 5 years ago, I had to find somebody who understood AI, I'd be like, a what? Like we just don't know. So we used to look for certain things and they kind of come down into these buckets. There's five, but there might be six right now.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm still working on it, but basically, loosely speaking, it's hunger, weight, tenacity, speed, and grit. And a neuroplasticity may be one of them. I'm working on that one.
Yeah.
Hunger. How much does somebody really want it? Like, is this their goal or is it somebody else's goal? Because you can't be insatiably hungry for someone else's goal. So like, why do they care about this thing? Like that tells me how hard they're going to work for this thing. So hunger. Weight. How serious are they? How much gravitas do they have? Can I put them in front of my most important client? Can I put them on my biggest deal? Can I have them negotiate Israeli-Palestinian peace, right? Like how serious of a human are they?
Yeah.
Tenacity. How many times are they willing to go back over and over and over in order to get something right? Like how hard are they willing to work? Hunger, weight, tenacity, speed. How smart are they? Like how fast are they from failure to fix? How quickly do they realize things are going sideways and they know to switch it? How quick are they to problem solve and find the people that they want to talk to? So that's speed. And then grit. Are they tough? Can they take bad news? Can they stay uncomfortable just long enough to actually be able to learn something? Like, are they okay? Are they comfortable being uncomfortable? And then this plasticity that I'm thinking about came out of a conversation I had with somebody just a couple days ago, where it's sort of like, how can they take information that's both translatable and transferable and bring them into something that's new? So for example, if you are a salesperson at a at a pharma company and you're looking for a job as a salesperson in another pharma company, that's a directly transferable set of skills. Yeah. But if you're a salesperson at a pharma company and you want to go into raising money on behalf of a nonprofit cause, that's a translatable skill set. Why? Because what do they need to do? They need to research prospects. They need to steward relationships. They need to know when to make an ask. They need to know how big of an ask, how to steward it after, how to bring them up the ladder, right? Yeah. So it's the same skill set. They're not out of their depth. They're just out of their lexicon. Yeah. So how plastic is their brain? Are they able to take things that they learn in one place and apply them to another? And my thinking is that I want to go through the research of this book and talk to legendary talent spotters, like NCAA coaches, A&R executives at record companies, casting agents. Like, who are the people who have always been really good at like spotting talent? And then I want to do a research project and figure out, like, take, you know, like 10,000 people and say, have you ever hired somebody who didn't have all the skills? What are these traits that they had? What are the must-haves? What are the would be nice to haves? What are the would like to have if I had a magic wand? So I do think hunger, weight, tenacity, speed, and grit, and then probably plasticity, as demonstrated in stories that they tell from their past, because past is prologue. So what are the stories they're telling? And in those stories, do they talk about picking themselves back up, learning something new, applying something that they learned from being the head of the PTA into the thing that they're doing with their, you know, their big deal? Like, are they demonstrating these things in the conversation that we're having, instead of just talking about, you know, their big giant goals they have, which are pulled out of the sky?
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. I love how quickly you just spit that off, right? It sounds like the book is half written already, but like you said it very quickly and eloquently, and I totally got it.
Well, I've been thinking about it for 30 years. You know, I wrote Limitless. My first book took me 6 weeks to write. And it took me 6 weeks to write because it took me 25 years and 6 weeks to come up with it. Yeah. Wonder Hell, the next book, took me 2 years to write because I was living it as I was writing. And in this one really is like, I've been thinking about it for a long time. Yeah. So it is well rehearsed in my brain. I always say I'm a very fast writer, but I'm a very slow thinker. Okay. So I sort of think and I think and I think and I think, and then like it comes to me and then it's ready to pour out. So
yeah.
Like, what do you think about that? I'm curious about you talk to a lot of people. You're very well, widely read. How does it strike you?
I think it's excellent. Like my first impression is like, yes, that is a great framework against which to assess like a person's talent, and really easily digestible, right? Like I could walk away right now with that and walk away from this podcast. And it's like, I've learned something useful just based on this, you know, 4 minute dialogue about it. So that to me indicates it's got importance, it's got relevance, and it's going to be useful. So I would say that's a very good sign, and take this from a guy who has two published books that have sold virtually no copies. So maybe my knowledge about how to produce a good work is not useful here, but, so I'd say that's great. I guess the things that come up for me as an immediate reaction, which is as a potential candidate, because I imagine the people who are going to be reading it would be more like the candidates about like, how do I get ahead? Right. If I saw that book, that would be the mindset. It's like, okay, so besides learning how to fake those five qualities, how do I actually like learn something from this to help me get ahead? Right. And I'm sure that's part of the thinking of where the book goes, but,
So I'm thinking the book is going to be sort of three sections, right? There's a discussion about what these things are, these traits that people who can be great anywhere have. Number one. Number two, there's the, I would say whatever the opposite of them would be. I don't know. I got to come up with a fancy term for that. But, you know, somebody who doesn't have grit is somebody who gives up too easily, right? What does that look like? Somebody who, or points the fingers at other people. Somebody who doesn't have speed, never asks for help. They make the same mistakes over and over again, right? So what does it look like? Like when somebody tells you a story, what are you listening for that are also the red flags, right? Green flags and red flags.
Yeah.
And then then the third section would probably be comorbidities. So somebody who has tons of grit, who's willing to go again and again and again, are they also perfectionists? Like, is it never good enough, right? So like, how does it look if you bring them into your organization and they seem like they're great because they have all these things, do they become toxic because they have these comorbidities that then affect them and everyone else around them? And so I think throughout these, I would probably talk about how we listen for that in conversation and also how we demonstrate it in conversation if we're trying to show it. And then within that is like, if you're trying to build more of these things, here are some things to go do, right? Like here are ideas and mindset shifts and all of that. So I think in the, I think a lot of that's going to come from some of the anecdotal conversations that I have with people who are good at doing this. You know, Dawn Staley, who is the head coach of the University of South Carolina women's national championship basketball team, I saw she said something about a week after they won the championship, which was to the something like, "I don't care how good of a basketball player a high schooler is, if they disrespect their parents, I will not recruit them."
Wow.
That's weight, right? Like, do you respect the rules? Do you respect authority? Are you willing? Like, so like, I think that there are going to be a lot of those kinds of stories. So, okay, it's good to take a lens and put it back on yourself and say, okay, well, how am I showing up in the world? You know, am I showing up in the world where, you know, I say I'm a nice guy, but I'm an asshole to waiters?
Yeah.
You know, maybe not so much. So really thinking about how we are perceived, and is it the same way that we think we're being perceived?
Right. Right, which is one of the concepts in some ways that came up in Wonderhell a little bit when you were talking about, you know, we are who we think other people think we are. One other thought I'll just share with you before we move on, which is
please,
the other thing that came up. There was a CEO I met in New York of this agency called Journey, and he ascribed his superpower to actually ayahuasca. And I'm not necessarily promoting psychedelics here, but he said it taught him a level of empathy, you know, and creativity that most leaders don't have, that he can get the most out of people because he can very much put themselves in their shoes, know how to motivate them and get the most out of them. And, you know, so the one, when you talked about neuroplasticity within that construct, it's like, where does creativity and innovative thinking sit within those five or six? And I don't know how you necessarily document that or, but.
Yeah, I don't know. And there may be, you know, like an empathy bucket, or my guess is that I'm going to look back on this interview and be like, oh God, those were the wrong buckets. But I think there'll probably be 10 overall, right? Like what are the things, that people look for? And once I've got the 10 buckets, then I'll do an assessment project. And from that, the question is, which are the two or three that are non-negotiables? Like people you absolutely have to have hunger. Like if you don't have hunger at the end of the day, like it just doesn't matter, because you will eventually stop caring enough to bring your best self. I don't know. But you know, empathy, emotional intelligence, like there may be some other things that go into this. But I'm fascinated by this question that anyone can be great in any situation. Obviously, like, you know, if you're a brain surgeon, you actually need to know how to do brain surgery. But like among the brain surgeons, who can be the great brain surgeon? And what does that take, right? Clearly empathy, bedside manner, that's part of it. So I'm interested in this idea that anyone has the potential to be great. It's just that if we're not being great, and maybe that we're just in the wrong place. Like there's that very trite expression, like if the flower is not blooming, you don't blame the flower, you change the soil. Maybe you're not great because you're just not in the right soil. Like maybe you need to be somewhere else where you can demonstrate these things. So if the environment that you're in isn't bringing out the best in you, you got to change the environment. And I think it would be very helpful as a manager looking at people, as a leader looking at their people, to figure out how do I get the best out of my people, but also as a parent, you know, like I may be pushing my kid in a certain direction, but they're not hungry for it. They're not learning from it. They're not willing to like work hard in the dark when nobody sees to get better at the thing, right? They don't have hunger or tenacity or speed, or they don't have any of these things about this thing that I'm pushing them to. Another ridiculous Instagram meme I saw the other day was, "Mom, you're not the daughter I raised," and "Daughter, no, I'm not the outcome you desired." And I was like, oh, that's deep, right? So like, I don't know. It's everything I think about is why success doesn't equal happiness, right? So it's all like along the same lines of pushing, hustling towards what? And do we actually care about the thing we're hustling towards?
That's like a great segue, but I have to ask this question because it's like one of my like deeps a little bit, which is like, I think there's a lot of juice in exactly what you talked about, right? Like the juice is very much worth the squeeze. But what I find is there's so many, I'm going to broadly bucket it as a self-help book, you know, that has great ideas, but like to actually, for people to actually get the value out of it, I feel like they need support. Like I see all these coaching books being like, here's how you run a business, here's how you do this thing. And it's like, okay, here's like a manual that gives me like a 0.5% of what I actually need, but I don't have any support to do it. And so to what extent do you feel like there needs to be deeper support beyond the book? Like the book is just kind of like the opening, but how do people actually do that? It feels like there needs to be more, right?
I think there needs to be more actually before the book as well. Right. So when Limitless came out, I would try to give the keynote and like, I was like, I'm going to tell them everything. They need to know everything in the book. Turns out people don't want to know everything. They don't care about everything. They're too tired to digest everything. They've got, you know, like the supercomputer in their pocket is telling them about, you know, world events and their kids and everything else going on. Like they don't have that focus.
Yeah.
And then I realized it was even more than that. Like, not only do I have to give them the most simplified, here's the one thing to walk away with, they have to walk away with the belief that they can do it, that it's for them. Like, it's almost like the keynote is the prologue to the book. Like, you can do this. I believe in you and I'm going to help. And here's one thing to take away today. Yeah. And then from that, you can then read the book. And then once you've read the book, here's the course or here's the coaching or here's the whatever, or here's the way to create the, you know, the collection of friends and family around you that I call family that will actually help you get there together. So I don't know. I read a long time ago, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I read a long time ago that most celebrity chefs, when they publish a book of their recipes, leave out like key things. Like either it's like a step or like one little ingredient that's like, oh, and I also add a little teaspoon of soy sauce to my tomato soup that gives it like umami. Like they just don't tell you about that. So you're like, how is this not as good as when I had at the restaurant? I have the recipe. Yeah. Like they don't give you everything, right? And I feel like a lot of self-help authors don't give you everything because they need you to keep coming to them. You got to keep going to get the tomato soup because you love it. So when I wrote Limitless, which is all about how to change yourself or your career or your workplace to actually enjoy your success, I thought I wrote a business book.
Right.
And then before the book came out in April, before the book came out in January, I got invited to do the Today Show. And I got invited to do the 9 a.m. hour, which is like Hoda and Jenna, which are like the stay-at-home moms.
Yeah.
And I said to my publicist, I was like, I don't understand. I wrote a business book. Like, why am I doing the stay-at-home mom hour? And she was like, it's not a business book. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, it's a self-help book. And I literally wrote a blog post that was titled something like, oh no, I wrote a self-help book, because I had a lot of disdain for self-help at that point. And then I came to understand that self-help was actually pretty hard, because I bring the help, but everyone has to bring the self. And the self means that they have to decide they need to change, which is hard. They have to decide they want to change, which is harder. They have to decide that they're worthy of the change, which is harder still. They have to be supported by people around them who are used to them either fitting into a box, fitting into a shortcut, being small so they can be big, right? Again, harder, harder, harder. And I realized that self-help is actually pretty awesome. That said, I also believe that most of the self-help industry is built to make you continue to need them so they can continue to sell you shit. And my favorite blurb that I got for Limitless actually comes from one of our fellow Mastermind Talk members, Jordan Harbinger, who I then went on to profile in Wonder Hell. But his blurb for the paperback version of Limitless said something like, in a sea of soul-sucking self-help garbage, finally a book that doesn't make you feel worse after you start it than before you finish it. And I was like, yes!
That's an endorsement.
Perfect! That's my favorite. So I think there's a lot of the self-help industry depends on us feeling kind of shitty about ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's what we're customers.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff we're sold, not just in the self-help industry, you know, capitalism in many ways and commercialism is driven a lot by that, right? We just talked.
Yeah. I mean, we're like one purchase, one promotion, one diet, one marriage, one divorce, one whatever away from finally being happy.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Perfect segue into Wonder Hell. So what inspired Wonder Hell? Where was the moment where you're like, I got to write this book next?
Well, I was in Wonder Hell. This is the problem. So Limitless comes out, I do a whole bunch of speaking. Limitless comes out, I do a whole bunch of speaking, and I am in Vancouver. I'm giving a keynote, and I'm literally like opening for Malala. Like there are five women on the undercard, or four women on the other card, and Malala's like the big name.
Yeah.
And this was like the third or fourth keynote I'd ever given in my life. There were three events. Two of them, Malala was the top name. And then the third one, Robin Roberts, was the top name because Malala was like 20 and had to go back to college and take finals or something during the third event. So I had taken a photo with Malala 2 days before, and then I'm on this red eye and I'm flying back home, and the book is coming out like the day before, right? So I'm like in the book launch week, as you know, and I am, I'm flipping through my phone on this red eye because it's like 4 a.m. and I can't fall asleep. And I'm just like, I'm sandwiched between these two linebackers, and I'm on Wi-Fi and I'm flipping through the photos, and I see this photo of me with Malala, which, by the way, if that sounds super douchey, Malala looked like super like composed and amazing. And I look like a troll from like under the bridge because I was like, oh my God, it's Malala, right? Like it was just... I saw her in the green room and I was like, I gotta go talk to her. Like, she's Malala. Like, when am I ever gonna talk to Malala again? Like, this is amazing. Yeah. And I see her and I'm like walking across the room thinking to myself, like, you're an icon. You're amazing. Thank you for being such a hero. And then I get to her and I notice she's wearing the most amazing pair of red suede stiletto shoes. And literally my moment with Malala was her looking up from sitting down and me going, I like your shoes. That was it. That's what I did. And because she's Malala, she looked at me and she was like, would you like to take a selfie? And I was like, yes, please. So we stood up to take a selfie. So I'm on the plane and I'm flipping through and I see the photo of me troll under the bridge with, you know, Nobel Prize winner Malala. And I get a text in that moment from my publisher saying your book just debuted on the Washington Post bestseller list, number 2.
Wow.
And I was so exhausted from the work that it took to do those keynotes, like 3 keynotes in 2 weeks all across Canada, 2,500 people at each one, having given this my 3rd, 4th, and 5th keynote of my life, like completely, like, you know, book launches are like you're fueled by just stress and coffee and, you know, protein bars, and that's about it. And in that moment, because I was so tired, like the part of my humility that normally, you know, my brain that normally governs my humility, it was just gone. Like I left it in the waiting room in the Vancouver airport. And I was like, number 2, how do I get to be number 1? Literally, that was my first thought. And then right after that thought, all I could think of was, who are you to want that? Like, right. you don't even belong on the Washington Post list. Like, who bought your book? Why would they even care? What are you thinking, number 1? Who are you? But I couldn't not see that version of myself. Like I had this idea that like, if I wrote another book, could I get on the Wall Street Journal list? Could I get on the New York Times list? Could I get to be number 1? Like, how do I do this? And once you see that version of yourself, you can't unsee it, right? It's why internal candidates always leave if they don't get the job, because the very process of interviewing for the job means that they have to wear the clothes of that role and speak in the voice of that role and dress in, you know, like they have to imagine possibilities. And you can't put the toothpaste back in the bottle. You can't unimagine yourself in this sort of level of greatness. So there I was, and I was stuck in this moment. I opened up my laptop. I wrote this long screed of a Facebook post, and I was like, I don't know where I am right now. I'm like 1,500 miles from where I started and 1,500 miles from where I'm going, and I don't know what day of the week it is, but all I know is that I am in wonder hell. Like, it is amazing. It's exciting. It's humbling. It's wonderful. And also, I'm now filled with anxiety and uncertainty and doubt and exhaustion and imposter syndrome. And it's kind of hell. Like, it's kind of wonder hell. And now I'm stuck with this burden of my potential and I don't really know what to do with it. And literally within like a half hour of posting that, again, it's 4 a.m. wherever I am. So it's like 7 a.m. in the East Coast. It got like likes and shares and people were like, that's a great word. And you should buy the URL. And, and my publisher was like, not for nothing. I would make a great title of the next book. And then I got home and I didn't think about it again. And 4 months later, the pandemic happened.
Right.
And I completely forgot about it until a Facebook memory popped up about 5 weeks into the pandemic that was like, hello, here's a memory, wonder hell. And I was like, fascinating. So I had spent the month before interviewing all of these people, just like doing a podcast, interviewing interesting people, because we're all busy creating content, right, for the pandemic. And what I realized when the Facebook memory popped up, I was like, I'll be damned. Every one of these conversations about the moment in your life when everything changed was about a moment when somebody was in wonder hell.
Right.
I should write that book. And so, yeah, I mean, I wrote it because I was in it and I really wanted to figure out a way out of it. And then much to my chagrin and also much to my liberation, I realized that nobody, like these Olympic medalists, these startup unicorns, these, you know, billion-dollar founders, first of glass ceiling shatterers, none of them ever got out of it. They just found the next Wonder Hell and the next Wonder Hell and the next Wonder Hell, which again was horrifying and also really liberating. So I was like, oh, okay. So we can always be in between who we were yesterday and who we're becoming tomorrow. Cool. Great. Now I can be comfortable because I know discomfort is, that's it. Like, yeah. That's where we are.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. It's, in a different word, it's like dread, right? It's like the fear of becoming, right? Of who you're yes. becoming, which is it's by definition unknown, right? And the only thing to really ever fear is the unknown because it's by definition unknown. And I think that's totally on point. So if this is a keynote, what is the one takeaway that you would give all the keynote listeners right now for Wonder Health?
Yeah. So the keynote sort of goes through, 3 points. But the main point is that the people who thrived in Wonder Hell renegotiated their relationship with the tsunami of emotions that come at them. Because at any given moment in your life, you may be feeling uncertainty, imposter syndrome, dread, exhaustion, envy. It just depends on where you are at this moment of your life. Like it's not a linear path. They don't come in a certain order. So the people who I spoke to who not just survived but thrived, they renegotiated their relationship with these emotions. So instead of saying, this is a limitation. The stress and the uncertainty is a limitation. Oh no, I haven't done this before. They saw it actually as a cheering section, as an invitation. And they said, oh wow, I haven't done this before, which gave them unlimited right to not know anything, to ask questions, to try to solve problems, to look for mentors, to not have everything all figured out and be perfect from the start. And so just this mindset shift of this feeling that you're having isn't a limitation, but it's an invitation to what comes next. And if you're lucky, what comes after that and after that and after that was the fundamental shift that helped people really not just enjoy, you know, be able to withstand it, but really look forward to it and enjoy it and learn from it and grow from it.
Yeah.
Hey, podcast people, this is the producer, Chris. And at this point, we had some technical difficulties with Ronan's notoriously bad connectivity. And honestly, I'm not seeing a clear, seamless transition I can make other than to just interject right here and say, in our intermission, we started talking about the state of the self-help and personal development world, and the topic of grifters came up. Then we started recording again, and well, let's dive back in.
Yeah, so do you want to speak to Chris's question? It's funny, because like we were just, right before you joined, as I mentioned, we spent an hour having a conversation about subjects like this, and I forgot to hit record. it is germane, because a lot of podcasting, frankly, I mean, we're talking more specifically about podcasting, but, you know, it's about grifters selling, you know, bad information, you know, usually well-intentioned, but bad information or oversimplified stuff and getting people on the treadmill.
Oh, I mean, you want to talk about grifters. Yeah. Let's talk about grifters. The other B that I have in my bonnet is that I want to have t-shirts printed that say, before you tell me what to do, show me what you've done.
Interesting.
And on the back of it, it will be like hashtag give me your P&L, right? Like I just, there are so many people, like I believe that there are people who are not doing and that they are teaching, and there are people who are very good at teaching. Fine. Great. Amazing. But there are also people who not only didn't do, they also don't know what they're talking about and they're still teaching because they read a couple of books or they went to somebody's course and now they're basically giving what my friend, the speaker and author Scott McCain calls book reports, right? Yep. So there are a lot of people in my industry who get up on stage and they give a 45-minute keynote about something that they really don't actually know. Yep. And I think if you don't know something from living through it or from researching it, then you don't actually have the right to be up there talking about it. Now, I think there are people who you know, you take someone like Jesse Itzler, right? Jesse's built a bunch of billion-dollar companies. He can talk about entrepreneurship. Amazing. Or you take somebody like our mutual friend David Berkus, who writes about management and leadership, but he's never managed or led anything, but he's researched it through PhD scholarly work, right? So like there's doing and there's researching.
Yeah.
But then there's like a lot of other people who literally have spent like 6 minutes thinking about this stuff, and they're basically fetuses, and they're up there on stage and they're giving these talks. And I think it's malpractice because people will literally make decisions in their lives, in their companies, in their relationships, in their communities, based on what you're saying. I remember at that Vancouver event, actually, somebody came up to me in the audience and she's like, I read the first half of your book and I quit my job. And I wanted to be like, read the second half. Like, I don't, oh my God. But so I think people are getting on stage having read the first half of the book. And I think it is so irresponsible. So you have that that's going on at the same time as you have the rise of these like internet influencer celebrity proximate people, right? Yep. They're not quite celebrities, but they're proximate to celebrity, or they can sort of cosplay celebrity. And they put themselves up in the world as gurus, as these gurus who know all the things. When again, they've thought about it for 6 minutes. And so because we live in a world where if I'm feeling insecure about myself, but I can go on your Instagram feed and every morning I can get like a 3 minute, here's a quick tip on what to do. There doesn't have to be any depth there. Yeah. But it makes me feel good. And I get like I get a little, you know,
dopamine
boost. Yeah. And I'm like, yay, they see me. You know, it's like this like psycho pop stuff where it doesn't actually have to be deep. It's like somebody who's reading your palm, or like tarot card reading, or, you know, like crystal ball. Like they say like a lot of things like, you seem, I can feel that relationships are important to you, that there's a very important relationship we're thinking about right now. It's like, well, of course there is. Your relationship could be with your dog. It could be with your spouse. It could be with, you know, a high school friend that you've just like gotten to talk to again. Like it feels like it's specific to you, but it's very generic. And so you get these little like 30-second little generic boosts that don't actually do anything. And then we don't actually change because there's nobody holding us accountable.
Right.
Like, yes, I want to get up and exercise. I want to, you know, be better as a spouse. I want to bring my best to work every day. But are you? And what's the consequence if you don't? Yeah. There's no consequence. So we don't have to change because we know tomorrow there's going to be yet just another 30-second little, you know, Lucky Charm marshmallow.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of a couple of things, like the expression that most people would be certain they're miserable and never take a chance on being happy. You know, the control of it. And you're also talking about like the point I was raising, which is like, there's a lot of books out there, which like gives you a little bit, but not enough to, you know, there's a few people who would be like, you know what, Laura, that book inspired me to do the thing. And now I'm holding myself to account and have that self-motivation to do the thing. And they just needed the kick in the butt to go over the ledge. But for a lot of people, they'll read the book. They'll be like, oh, I should do that. And then like, there's just no follow-up, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite Amazon review of Limitless was a guy who said, I left my tenured professorship in philosophy to finally pursue my dream of writing science fiction. I was like, that's amazing. That's amazing. I think most people don't change. You know, again, in this industry, I'm surrounded by people who will post a photo or a video of them at a speaking event. And they're like, I impacted 2,000 people today. And I want to be like, you maybe impacted two. Like the other 1,998 are not paying attention, or they're on their phone, or they just don't care. Like we need to take it down a notch about how important we are, right? And like, I would rather go deeper with a few than have this like, I'm going to change the world, because we're not. I mean, come on. Like, it's a little arrogant, right? No. To think that we're making that much of an impact on people. But what I would say is that if you're somebody who actually does want to change, I would say like, what is the thing that you want to change? Not all the things, but like, what is the one thing that you want to change? And then like, what is the smallest possible deliverable every single week that you can have? And what's the smallest possible deliverable every single day? And it's not sexy to change like in micro steps.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like nobody's going to sell a $1 billion course with these little micro steps. They're selling a $1 billion course because they're promising you the world. I think most people are not, they're not going to do it because they don't care enough about it. And I think a lot of these self-help, I think a lot of the self-helpers that are out there are pushing you towards the sort of socially acceptable goals, yeah. Fancier cars, bigger houses, smaller clothing sizes, all that stuff. But like, do you care about that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I had one reader say to me, you know, I picked up your book because a friend of mine recommended it and I wasn't going to read it because I thought it was going to tell me how to have a better career. Yeah. When really what I want to do is I want to move into the countryside and make my own energy and grow my own food.
Yeah.
And then I read your book and I realized you're telling me that it's okay to have that goal because I can just define success for myself. Yeah. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Shocking concept.
That was actually like when I first saw the cover of the book, when you first published it, and it was the, you know, why success doesn't feel like it should. And like my first thought is it's because a lot of what people define as success is what we've been told to define as success, right? Like in,
exactly.
You know, when people talk about like, I want my kids to be, you know, happy, healthy, and fulfilled, they didn't really just like want them to have a good career. Cause like as a parent, you've kind of like, that's a metric in many ways, being like, ah, oh, my kid is a contributing member of society, but it really fulfillment is a very different concept. And I think that's the thing, is like so much of what we work for. And that was like, when I started reading it, like it was going to be one of my critiques until you raised this point, which is like, all of this is like, often it gets grounded in like how to get the better job, how to get the car, the house, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, speaking personally, like as the guy who was on that path, going to law school, get a job, make lots of money, get the house, get the wife, get the, you know, all of a sudden you do it. Yep. And then you're faced with two problems. One is like, now you got to pay for all of it and you've done all this work. And then you realize that, oh, this never was actually what I wanted. Or even if it was what I wanted, it's not nearly as fulfilling as I thought it would be. But now I don't have anything to chase and distract myself with in terms of, you know, keeping myself satiated. So now I have to like almost start anew.
Well, you got multiple problems going on there, right? Because you've got the hedonic treadmill. We're like, okay, I made this money, so I joined the country club. But oh, across the street, there's a fancier country club. And then you join that country club. And then you realize across the street, there's another fancier one. But that costs a lot of money. So you're working even harder. And the only time you see the country club is when your kids post on Instagram from the pool. And you're like, wow, how lucky for them, right? So like the hedonic treadmill has us like, we keep chasing and chasing and chasing and chasing. But we're so busy chasing that we don't stop to ask ourselves if we want to keep chasing. So like, that's the first problem that's going on. And then there's this problem of the fact that we're asked to pick a direction, to pick a path, to pick a trade, to pick a major, to pick a college when we're like 16 years old.
Yeah.
And like, you know what you don't have when you're 16 years old? Your frontal lobe. Like the actual part of your brain that dictates good, sound, logical decision making doesn't actually fully form until 10 years after you're asked to make this very important decision about what the rest of your life is going to look like. Yep. So is it any question that we wake up? Is it any wonder we wake up at like 26, 36, 46, 56, and we're like, oh, is this all there is? Like, is this all my life is going to be? And then you're like, well, now what do I do?
Yep.
Because I can't undo everything, because what's everyone going to think? Again, nobody's going to care, right? So, and by the way, they might be really jealous. Like, I think there are so many people that we run into at the coffee shop. We tell them our like big, crazy, hairy, scary dreams that we're going to change everything. And they look at us and they're like, oh, okay. And they don't know what to do, because either A, they love us and they don't want to see us get hurt, right? So they're worried about us, but awesome, fine, great, wonderful, you can stay. But also, maybe I'm not going to tell you about my stuff when it's completely ill-formed. I'm going to wait until I know a little more about it, number one. Number two, maybe they're jealous, right? Because they're like, oh, well, I thought about you here. And if you rise to here, then what does that mean about me? Right? They liked you when you were smaller because it made them bigger. Maybe they're just scared. And you're like, oh, well, I can't do that because they said it's too scary. But what they really meant is like, it's too scary for them.
Yeah.
And then the people, like, it threatens everything they hold dear if you do something totally different. Because they're like, well, if you're not on the partner track, or if you're leaving the partnership, what was I doing all this time? What was I sacrificing for? Did I make a mistake? And so I think we spend so much time with our antenna pointed outward about what success should be. I mean, we're given that definition by like, you know, the internet, by the Kardashians, by celebrities, you know, whatever it should look like. And then we follow it. And then we don't give ourselves any grace to change our minds ever.
Yeah.
And the truth is, like, people are cheering for you to be successful. They're also not paying that much attention to even know if you are or not. But like the people who are closest to you they'll want you to be happy. And I mean, as the great poet laureate of our generation, Taylor Swift says, the trash takes itself out, right? So like whoever's not happy for you, fuck them. you know, life's too short.
Yeah. A couple of thoughts that like are top of mind, which is like one of the things I'm taking away from this conversation, which is maybe one of the themes I'm going to try to emphasize in this podcast, is really appreciating like the incremental steps. Like we only value, like you've heard the parable of like, you know, it took me 20 years to be able to write a, you know, overnight success.
Yeah.
And so those are easy.
I think it was Miles Davis maybe who said it took him 20 years to sound like himself.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And we belittle like those small incremental steps, but as Erwin, my teacher, points out, like if you're on this path and you make a 1% shift, you know, over time, it's actually, you end up very far away from where you started, but you know, you've got to take it step by step. The question I have though, and like, where is the balance, which is like, you know, someone could take that viewpoint of like, fuck everybody else and like do what matters to you. But there is, you know, an innate need to be accepted, and like society works because there's a social contract of some form. And I'm first to agree that the nature of the social contract is way too strict right now. You know, going back to cancel culture as a simple example, but at the same token, like if everyone's just doing whatever the fuck they want, you know, going back to the Simpsons, be like the boy, you know, things start to fall apart. So how do you for yourself kind of navigate that coherently?
I just don't tell everybody 100% of everything.
Okay.
I mean, when I wanted to leave the big search firm and start my own, my parents were like, what are you doing? Right. How are you going to do that? Are you going to, what's going to happen? Where are you going to pay your bills? Because the last time I lived in the same house as them, I put the empty milk carton back in the refrigerator and bought the car back late for curfew with no gasoline. Like they thought I was a moron.
Yeah.
It's not that I was incapable. It's not that they didn't love me. They just didn't know me. Right. Yeah. So I then, when it came time to sell that search firm 15 years later, I didn't tell them about it until I was already like well on the way to the next thing I was doing. I mean, obviously I wasn't going to work at the search firm anymore, but I was like, So I'm, you know, I sold the firm. You know, in a couple months I'm leaving, and then here's what I'm gonna do next. But I invited them in later in the process.
Right.
So, and like on social media, I share 100% of about 60% of my life. I don't share everything about everything, right? Yeah. But I share certain things that make sense to me at certain times. So, you know, I'm not doing whatever the fuck I want whenever the fuck I want to, but I'm not asking for opinions all along the way until I know what I'm doing. So what I'm sharing with the world fits into the social construct in the way that is comfortable for it, but doesn't stop me from experimenting and figuring out who I want to be in the world. And I think, you know, as long as you're not like tying kids to looms in Bangladesh, like you're not actively causing harm in the world, do what you want to do.
Yeah.
For sure.
Jack.
But you should vote. Voting matters. To go back to the beginning of our conversation.
Well, I'll ask you about that because, like, Jack. I always forget mix up the golfer and the actor. Jack Nicklaus.
Oh, Jack Nicklaus. Yeah.
Yeah. Who said, like, I am who I am. Your approval is not required. You know, I've always found that to be super, but it's hard. You know, we get raised, you know, being rewarded for compliant, complicit little people, right? You do what you're told, you get rewarded with getting to watch TV or whatever it is. And it's a big thing to try and unlearn too.
I'll leave you with this. I think I've come to the realization that there's a million billion miles between being loved and being seen. Right. So we're raised as little children to be nice and complicit and do our chores and get good grades. And our parents are like, oh, you did a good job. I love you. And you're like, okay, yay me. But when you were growing up, were you able to just like be a total weirdo and still know that like everyone around you would love you anyway? I mean, I wasn't. I was complicit. I was compliant, right? I was compliant and I was who I was supposed to be. And it wasn't like I had some like weird, like crazy thing in the background that I wasn't sharing, but like I didn't even experiment with who I could be or wanted to be because I was like, this was the box that I was supposed to fit in. And that box was the person who is loved.
Yep.
And it wasn't until many years later and a lot of therapy that I realized that the biggest gift that we can give people in our lives is not just to love them, but to really truly see them and love them for that person that they are.
Yeah.
And if there's people in your life who are not willing to actually see you, it's not even like your opinion of me is none of my business. It's that you don't even get a vote. Like you're not even on my radar because you are giving me an opinion of the person who you're loving, but you're not actually seeing who I am.
Right.
You're not seeing what I can do. So it's, you're not even giving me an opinion about the person I actually am.
Yeah. Yeah. My 5-year-old is totally, I don't know if you can see that picture, but the one in front is my 5-year-old.
He's laying totally, on the, so cute.
My wife and I are in awe of him because he just does. Like, there is no filter in his
mind. Everyone's like, oh, he beats to the beat of his own drummer. Like, if it's like, he's a weirdo. It's like, no, that's awesome. Yeah. Those are the humans we love the most. Like, the adults we love the most are the ones who are interesting and creative and iconic, right? They're the ones who are like the iconoclasts. They're like the really super different people.
Yeah.
But that's not, you know, like when you're little, you have to get straight A's in every subject. I'm like, no, like we're not math and English and social studies and science kids. We're like, we have things that we do better than others, and we should get to be those people. We should be celebrated for being those people.
Yeah. Scott Galloway, I've heard him saying, I think you may have mentioned something similar, which is like, don't follow your passion, follow your talent. It's interesting. That's an interesting thought because it kind of runs a little bit contradictory to what you're saying, but there's just something I think very interesting about that. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think follow your passion is the world's worst advice. I think follow your passion is the spoken word illegitimate sister of the live, love, laugh tattoo. So, because it just tells people like, follow your passion. And as soon as you figure out what you're passionate about, you just have to follow it and everything will be great. Which means the minute that things are hard, the minute somebody says no, the minute you get rejected, you're like, oh, I guess this must not be my passion.
Right.
And then you do something else. But you got to invest in your passion. You got to spend some time working on it, right? That's where it comes back to grit and tenacity. Yeah. So follow your curiosity, I think is really important.
Yeah, exactly. I know we're at 3:30. I have tons of other questions because I'm loving this conversation, but I also want to be respectful of your time. So
I have a call starting at 3:30 that I'm not 2 minutes late for.
Okay. Well, I will let you go. If you ever have time to come back. No, it's okay. This has been awesome.
We'll have a part 2.
All right, let's do it. Thank you so much, Laura. Go to your call. I really appreciate it. This was lovely.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.